with construction well underway up on Mount Weitang. The daily routine changed somewhat for the Tenzhou Ravenhair complex. Field trips to the job site became the rule rather than the exception as the house took shape. All six members of the household, now that Nall was back in from the cold, as it were, also started spending more time in the city, jointly and severally, as they developed a sense of attachment to and involvement in the community. By early May, people had started filtering in from outside to visit as well, singly at first, then in small groups. Corwin's parents and various maternal relatives had the easiest time of it, with their ability to cross the Vale without having to take the time to make their way to Zipong first, though not all. Those of the family's friends who had school to attend wouldn't have the time to make the trip until after the end of the big universe academic year, but there were those who had more open schedules and could come and go as they pleased. Wednesday, May 5th. Mount Weitang. Uchna stood out in the meadow, chin thoughtfully in hand, and regarded the rising structure by the lakeshore with a critical eye. The main body of the house was fully framed now. Part of the crew was at work on the two-story section's roof, while another, out at the end of the single-story section, was in the process of putting up the structure for the tower. It was still a long way from finished, but the final shape of it could just about be made out if you knew what to look for. "It's really starting to look like a house," Uchna mused aloud. Next to her, Wakaba Shinohara nodded in sage agreement. "Sure is," she said. "Won't be long now before we can," Uchna said, then trailed off, her face becoming still more thoughtful as she mulled over present developments. She slowly turned her head to regard Wakaba, who was standing there, still looking at the house. After a few seconds, Wakaba seemed to feel Uchna's gaze on her. Turning, she met her old friend's azure eyes and replied artlessly, "What?" Uchna considered playing it just as cool for a second, then lunged and embraced Wakaba with a girlish squeal that would have struck many of her more recent acquaintances as unlikely. Wakaba's similar cry in return, not as much. They even jumped up and down a little bit while they were at it, as if striving to hit as many of the checkboxes as possible. "It's so good to see you," Uchna declared when they'd finished. "When did you get here?" "Just now," Wakaba replied with a grin. "Came in on the 1045 from Saikyo. This is quite a place you've got here." "How did you get up here from town?" Uchna wondered, looking around. There was just the usual assortment of construction crew vehicles and whatnot parked over by the portable project office. No sign of a rental car or any such. Wakaba smirked and thwacked Uchna gently on the back of the head, holding up her other hand to display the gently glowing green rose seal ring she wore. "Duh, I can fly," she said. Uchna snorted. "That wasn't ostentatious in any way," she observed dryly as the two started making their way toward the house. "When in Rome," Wakaba replied offhandedly, and Uchna wasn't even sure what she meant by that. Before she could ask, Wakaba went on, "I see you weren't exaggerating about your spot here. Dang, girl, this is too good for the likes of you." "What's that supposed to mean, huh?" Uchna demanded, hooking an arm around Wakaba's neck and miming a noogie. "Ow, somebody help, my prince is oppressing me," Wakaba complained. "So how long are you staying for?" asked Uchna. "Dunno," Wakaba replied. "I'm making it up as I go along, like always." Uchna laughed and turned her loose as they reached the house. "Same old Wakaba." Cupping her hands around her mouth, she called up to the roof, "Hey, Corwin, look who's here." Corwin, standing next to Rio with a sheaf of drawings in one hand, turned and looked down, then grinned and raised his free hand. Look at you, all architectural, Wakaba said, waving. The two men climbed down, unhitching their safety harnesses, and crossed so that Corwin could get a hug and Ryo could be introduced. Welcome, said Corwin as Wakaba embraced him. Just get in? Yeah, I thought I'd come up and surprise you, Wakaba said. Wakaba, this is Ryo Sato, old friend of mine, and kind of our general contractor on this job, said Corwin, gesturing. Hi, said Wakaba, bowing slightly. Wakaba Shinohara, I'm Utena's ex from middle school. Utena snorted and rolled her eyes. Wakaba. What? Said Wakaba, hands on hips with mock indignation. I said you could be my boyfriend in the 7th grade, and you said, fine, whatever, which I think you'll find is not a refusal. Anyway, she went on while Utena made a grumbly noise. Nice to meet you, Ryo. And you, said Ryo with a courtly bow. First visit to Dicho? Yep, Wakaba confirmed, nodding. I'm pretty impressed so far. She looked around. Hey, where's Anthe? And the baby? Do I not get to meet the baby? They stayed down at the air temple today, Utena told her. Anthe and Nima had something they were going to do. You can meet Annabelle when we get back, though. I assume you're going to want to crash with us and not in town someplace. Wakaba grinned. Yeah, if it's okay. I'd have called ahead, but it would have ruined the surprise, she added sheepishly. Oh, don't worry, said Corwin. There's plenty of room. Great. Who's Nima? You'll find out, said Utena with a little smile. Wakaba slotted neatly into the picture on Air Temple Island. Doing that kind of thing was a talent of hers, one of very long standing, and Utena had expected nothing less. She seemed to take no time at all to make friends with everybody on the island, then start branching out into town as well. With her around, everything seemed just that little bit livelier, and Utena was reminded, as she was every time they came back together after being separated by life for a while, how much she missed that when it was gone. A few days after Wakaba arrived, with the weather warming fast and a summery feeling in the air, Nima took Anthe, Annabelle, and Garnet on a whirlwind tour, no pun intended, of the air temples. Apart from the one they were already at, there were 4 of these, scattered around the world, and Nima predicted that it would take them 2 weeks to hit them all, not traveling by sky bison, which would have taken much longer, but hitchhiking, after a fashion, on cargo flights operated by the Air Commonwealth's national airline, the imaginatively named Nomad Air. They left early Saturday morning, and the day was full enough that the effect wasn't immediately noticeable. But 24 hours later, on Sunday morning, Corwin and Utena woke to find their world strangely quiet and empty feeling. They lay in bed for several minutes, silently contemplating this phenomenon together. Then Corwin sat up, yawned, and said, Boy, that's weird. I didn't think it would feel this weird. I know, Utena agreed, sitting up herself. One of us should have gone with them. Corwin tilted his head inquisitively. You figure a master airbender, the High Priestess of Sephiro, and a dragon aren't enough of an entourage? Utena gave him a look, then laughed. I suppose you have a point. She leaned and picked up her watch from the nightstand. They must be at the Southern Air Temple by now. Huh, said Garnet thoughtfully. Anthe turned her head to glance inquisitively at the little dragon on her shoulder, but Garnet didn't elaborate for a few seconds. Instead, she stood gazing around at the ranked statues, one depicting each of the known avatars. They really do look like they're all in line at the DMV, Garnet said at length, and Nima stifled a laugh that would have been inappropriate for this setting. Monday, May 10th. Air Temple Island. Republic City, Ticho. Cora put her head into the sun parlor and found Corwin by himself, fiddling around with something on the design desk station. "Hey," she said. Corwin looked up and smiled. "Hey." "You appear to have been abandoned," Cora observed. "Yep," Corwin agreed. "To be fair," he added, "I could have gone with, but I'm pretty demonstrably useless at ladies' fashion shopping, so..." He shrugged. "Better to stay behind and preserve the honor of the regiment, I think." Cora chuckled. "You can't be any worse at it than Lakpa," she said, crossing to sit down at the desk. "Probably not, but she enjoys sucking at it a lot more than I do," Corwin replied. "What you got there?" Cora held up the object in her hand, turning it so it caught the afternoon light. An optical disc of what, to Corwin, was an unfamiliar size. It was a little bit smaller in diameter than the ancient multi-disc form factor he was used to, and the spindle hole in the middle was square with slightly radiused corners, putting him in mind of old Earth Kingdom coins. "Something Karana gave me when I stopped by the arena earlier," she said. "It's a demo disc for a band some of the girls over at Sato Academy in Sakuragaoka have. Apparently it found its way to Karana by way of the pop club up at Piandao. You know how musicians like to network," she added with a grin. "She said they're big fans of Kate's and were hoping they could get it to her via me." Corwin grinned. "I like a band that's not afraid to dream big," he said. "Have you listened to it yet?" "Nope, I just got back," said Cora. "Shall we?" "Sure, I'm just killing time anyway," Corwin replied, putting the design desk in sleep mode. Cora turned her chair around and scooted over to the long table, switched on the portable stereo standing at one end of it, and stuck the light disc into the appropriate slot. There was no sound for a second or two. Then the clatter and thump of a mic being plugged in, and the unmistakable rustle and jangle of an idle but restless band. Footsteps receded from the mic, the fidgety noises stopped, and there was a moment of silence.
Hello out there," said a high-pitched, slightly breathy voice. "We're Hokago Tea Time. You probably knew that already. Oh, unless you found this disc on the train or something and it isn't marked, that could happen." Her voice became slightly muffled as the speaker turned away from the mic. Corwin didn't know what she looked like or how they were set up, but he could picture her anonymous form turning to address her equally nebulous bandmates anyway, and the thought made him smile a little.
"You guys, we should do that. Make some copies and just leave them lying around for people to find."
"Yui, we're recording," another voice said, with a note of long-suffering, fond exasperation in it that made both Corwin and Cora giggle.
"Oh, right, sorry. We're Hokago Tea Time."
"You said that already,"
a third voice interjected, unable to suppress a giggle.
"And we hope you like our songs. This one's called Rice is a Side Dish."
The third voice counted them in.
1, 2, 3, 4,
to the tapping of a hi-hat, so Corwin guessed its owner was the drummer, and they were off. Cora and Corwin listened to the first three tracks in silence, nodding their heads to the beat. The band was a little rough, as might be expected from what was evidently a high school music group, but they had a lot of energy, and their talent was evident even to Corwin's relatively untrained ear. They sounded like a four-piece, guitar, bass, drums, and a keyboard, and it appeared they had two singers. The girl with the high voice, Yui, evidently, did most of the leads, but one of the others, Corwin thought she was the one who had said, "We're recording," took over for the second track. Most of their lyrics were in Japanese, or Kokugo, Corwin supposed. "They're pretty good," Cora observed partway into the fourth track, which Yui, who did most of the talking, had introduced as "My Love is a Stapler." This had confused Cora for a few moments until she parsed enough of the lyrics to determine that it was a metaphor based on the idea of "my love" as in "for you," and not actually a declaration that the singer was in love with a stapler. Corwin nodded. "Their lead singer has a really cute voice," he said. "I can see where some people would find it kind of annoying, but I like her style. She's got a certain... je ne sais quoi." "I know exactly what you mean," said Cora in a slightly affected deadpan, and they both broke up snickering at the old in-joke. "The other one sounds more grown up," she added, as the band's second vocalist took over the lead for the next verse. "Yeah," Corwin agreed. "She kind of changes their whole sound. That's pretty cool." He nodded through the second chorus, the fingers of his own right hand unconsciously miming bass fingerings. "Yeah," he repeated. "I think Kate will dig this." He turned a thoughtful look to Cora. "Was there a picture with the disc?" Cora rolled her eyes. "Boys, that's all you ever think about." "I'm just curious," Corwin insisted, reddening. Giggling, Cora reached up and shoved his shoulder, causing his stool to swivel him through a full 360-degree turn. The fifth track was unmistakably a rock arrangement of the girls' school song, all but obligatory for school bands, and nicely accomplished in this case. It sounded like all four of them had vocal parts in that one, and Corwin found himself wondering idly which of the unfamiliar singing voices was whose. The demo's sixth and final track was a straight-up rock anthem with an insanely catchy hook, and got them both nodding along again. "This is the peppiest song I've ever heard about the agony of unrequited love," Corwin observed midway through the second chorus. "I know, right?" Cora agreed. They listened silently through the rest of the song. When it finished, there were a few extemporaneous remarks from band members before the recording abruptly cut off with a click. Corwin and Cora sat looking at the LD player for a couple of seconds, then turned to each other. "Not bad at all," Corwin pronounced. "Ship it. Shame there's only six tracks." "Well, it is an off-the-cuff demo," Cora said. She reached to remove the disc from the player, considered for a second, and then hit play again. "Makes me want to start a band," Corwin said after the first track was underway again. "Yeah, me too," Cora agreed. She put her feet up and leaned back, hands behind her head, to regard the ceiling thoughtfully. "I wonder where my old guitar ever ended up." "I'm home," Utina's voice called from the front hallway, shortly after the demo finished playing for the second time. "Anybody here?" "In here," Corwin and Cora declared together, then snickered at each other for the involuntary stereo response. Utina and Wakaba came in from the hallway, looking slightly tired but pleased from their day's exertions. Each was carrying a half-dozen shopping bags from various emporia around Republic City and sporting stylish new accessories.
"Well, look at you two," said Cora, grinning. "Looks like the day's expedition was a success."
"Thanks to me," Wakaba replied, striking a triumphant pose. "I love shopping with Utina. She makes me feel all expert-level girly."
"Hey," Utina objected. "I've learned a few of your tricks over the years. I even know what colors not to wear together." Yeah, but you still have the style sense of a high schooler. A boy high schooler, Wakaba said.
Did I, or did I not, pick out this scarf myself? Utina demanded, indicating the item she wore tied jauntily around her neck.
Did I, or did I not, have to tell you 3 times to pick a color other than black, and then you just went for red? Wakaba replied, rolling her eyes.
You're such a boy.
On a point of order, said Corwin, and that was as far as he got before they all broke up laughing.
Anyway, Wakaba went on, wiping tears of mirth from her eyes, shopping with Lakpa is good times, too. How anyone so naturally glamorous got to her age without knowing how to pick out clothes?
She shook her head.
Crime against nature.
How's she settling in? Cora asked. I should go out and visit sometime soon.
Oh, she's into the swing, Wakaba assured her, hopping up on the vacant stool in front of the drafting machine.
Got a job and everything.
Really? Doing what? Corwin wondered.
Delivering, Wakaba said.
Delivering what? Corwin asked.
Whatever she can carry, said Wakaba, shrugging. She's like a bike messenger, except she can fly. It's a great racket in a big city like this one. I wish I'd thought of it back in my ramen and water days in Nekomikoka.
Say, that is a good idea, Cora observed. Why didn't I ever think of that?
Like you need a job, said Utina with a cheerful roll of her eyes.
There have been times, said Cora, but she let it trail off and said, Hey, you guys want to hear something cool?
On Friday, Utina and Wakaba left as well, heading out to the big universe via Corwin's good offices with a parlor window, bound first for New Avalon, then Girado. Two of the current crop of DSM duelists, Boba Fett and Mimi Shinguchi, were graduating. As emerita officers of the Duelist Society, they felt honor-bound to attend, and besides, both of the younger duelists were friends. Left to their own devices, and with construction up on Mount Wei Tang having halted for the weekend, Cora and Corwin found themselves in the unaccustomed position of not having anything much to do on Saturday. Corwin was in the sun parlor, propped up on the futon reading a book, when Cora announced herself in the hall, then sloped into the room looking glum about something. Corwin marked his place, set the book aside, and gave her a curious look.
Problem?
Not really, Cora replied, sitting down next to him. I looked around for my guitar this morning, but I can't find it anywhere. I thought sure it'd be in the storeroom behind my office over in the ladies' quarters, but no sign of it.
She sighed. Must be in Senna. I guess I could call Kana and ask her to go take a look.
Corwin gave her a fondly skeptical look.
You have, what, 10 worldly possessions and you've managed to lose one?
Oh, sure, laugh it up, Cora replied, bumping his shoulder with hers. You wait until you're my age and then see how much of the stuff you had when you were 50 you can still find.
Well, did you look in the attic? Corwin suggested.
The ladies' dorm doesn't have an attic, she said.
What about here?
What would my guitar be doing in Tenzin's attic?
Corwin shrugged.
Ladies' dorm doesn't have one.
Cora gave a snort of laughter, conceding the point, and got up.
Well, what the heck, let's go see.
20 minutes later, Corwin and a slightly dusty, slightly sweaty Cora stood side by side next to the long table in the sun parlor, regarding the object she had just wrestled down through the narrow hatchway from the house's attic.
How did you know it would be there? She asked.
They do that, Corwin replied.
The object was a hard guitar case, one of the old-fashioned rectangular ones, its textured black vinyl covering cracked and peeling with age. After considering it for a few more moments, Corwin asked, How long was it up there, do you suppose? Well, I haven't played since...
Cora paused, her face clouding, then said in a lower voice,
Almost 40 years.
She shook her head, sighing.
Doesn't seem possible.
Corwin nodded, putting a hand on her shoulder, but said nothing. They stood looking at the case for a few more moments in silence. Then Cora seemed to shake herself, smiling, and said,
Let's see what we're up against.
So saying, she unfastened the case's latches and opened the lid. The instrument inside was a Fender Stratocaster, like Caitlin's favorite guitar, but built for a right-handed player and much more worn. At some point in its career, its body had been painted a light shade of blue, very like one Cora often wore, was wearing now, as a matter of fact. On the corner where her right forearm would have rested against it when she played, a patch of the blue paint had worn away, revealing the original three-tone brown sunburst finish underneath. The maple fingerboard was scored and grooved in the most commonly touched places, the frets worn. The once white pick guard and knobs had yellowed distinctly with age. The three thinnest strings had more or less disintegrated, and the others were badly corroded. There was rust, too, on the tremolo and the tuning machines. The wood looked to be in good shape, though, and in Corwin's eyes, the wooden parts of a Strat were like the frame of a spacecraft. Everything else could be replaced without changing the essential character of the thing. Cora wiped a tear from her eye at the sight of it.
Man, what a mess, she said, trying to sound jocular, but mostly failing.
I think it's fixable, though, Corwin mused. Tell you what, why don't you go get the hat, and we'll take it into town. There must be some place that does repairs.
After a little hunting around, they ended up in the basement of a huge multi-level music store with the slightly unintuitive name of Tengia, which sold records and sheet music at street level and musical instruments downstairs. At the back of the showroom, which Corwin made a mental note to bring Kate to when she was back in town, it was the kind of place where she could easily spend both a whole afternoon and a small fortune, there was a square island of counter with a sign hanging over it that read simply, Repairs. Corwin felt for the man on duty at that counter, who was bound by long-standing tradition not only not to recognize Cora, but to pretend this was just an ordinary job brought in by a regular member of the public. The luthier's name tag said he was called Dallas, and he was a foreigner in Dicha, a 30-ish white guy who reminded Corwin of Zach Stevens with some of his laid-back rocker guy mannerisms. He had clearly been in town for some time and knew the drill, though, and he spoke perfect Tongue-U. Corwin wondered what his story was, what had brought him to Republic City. He supposed it was probably a rock and roll thing. At any rate, when he opened the case, Dallas was visibly both a bit shocked and a bit pained by the state of the guitar. But when Cora gave him a sheepish smile and said, Pretty bad, huh? He couldn't bring himself to agree. Instead, he shook his head and said unconvincingly, Nah, not at all. Just needs a few minor adjustments. Corwin felt for the guy, but he also couldn't resist teasing him after an evasion as obvious as that. Turning to face away from the counter, he put a hand on Cora's shoulder and stage murmured to her, Maybe we should go somewhere else. I'm not sure this guy knows what he's talking about.
Behave, you, Cora chided him, shoving his near shoulder. Then, smiling at Dallas, she asked him,
Do you think you can do anything for it?
Oh, sure, Dallas replied, his professional pride nettled by Corwin's teasing. I mean, okay, look, I won't lie to you, your guitar's in pretty rough shape.
his confidence evident as he addressed what was, after all, his area of expertise. He went on, "The strings are the most obvious thing, but that's an easy fix. Frets are pretty worn, but, again, no real problem there. Based on the overall condition and the age of the instrument, though, I'm betting your electronics are completely shot, and I don't know if I can salvage this trem, either. But..." He lifted the Strat gently out of the case, then turned and placed it carefully on his workbench, positioning a neck rest just so. For a few moments he just stood regarding it, running his fingertips thoughtfully along the grooves in the fingerboard. Then he looked up from the guitar, turned back to the counter, met its owner's eyes, and smiled. "Yeah, man," he said. "I can save this axe." Cora grinned. "Then go to it, whatever you have to do." She reached and touched the worn-down spot on the body where the original finish showed through the blue paint. "Just leave this." "Not a problem," said Dallas with a knowing little nod. "It'll take me a couple hours. Feel free to look around the store, or just come back in a little while." They browsed the showroom for an hour or so, checking out the wide selection of equipment on offer. Then, as it was getting on toward dinner time anyway by then, they went down the way to the shopping arcade's food court and got a bite to eat. Cora was unusually quiet and pensive throughout the meal, and Corwin was reasonably sure he knew why. The length of time since she'd put away her guitar was a strong hint to someone who knew her history as well as he did. Rather than try to draw her out, he kept quiet and gave her space to work through it. Toward the end of the ice cream, she finally broke her silence, saying, "Hey, Corwin?" "Hmm?" he replied. "Say I actually wanted to visit Valhalla. What would that take?" Corwin nodded inwardly, called it, and smiled. They'd been creeping up on this through several incremental conversations over the last little while, and it didn't surprise him at all that they'd finally arrived at it today. "Well," he said, "we'd have to make some arrangements. You'd need a visa, naturally, and to get that you'd have to be sponsored, invited by one of the Aesir. I think we've got that covered," he added with a wry grin. "Mechanics-wise, we'd have to do some research on the celestial side, since we'd have to account for your own soul and Rava, too. Mom and Aunt Belle should be able to look after that. Beyond that, it's just a matter of getting you there, which I can handle myself." Cora mulled it over for a second or two, then asked, "How long do you figure that would take to set up?" "Depends on how long the research takes," Corwin said. "Couple of weeks, maybe a month, if they run into any snags with the paperwork." "Hmm." Cora said nothing further for a few moments, then finished her ice cream and rose from the table. "Well, let's go see how Dallas is getting on." Dallas, as it turned out, was getting on just fine. When they stepped off the escalator to the music shop's lower level, he was standing with his back to the room, playing a couple of riffs to test his work. When he'd finished, he turned around and saw them there, and they, in turn, saw the fruits of his labors. Cora's old Strat was still unmistakably the same vintage instrument. The worn paintwork was unchanged, as were the grooves in the fingerboard. All the metal gleamed like new, though, from the tremolo to the tuning knobs, and both she and Corwin could tell from the sound that the electronics were working perfectly. With a smiling nod for them, Dallas ducked out of the strap. "Good timing," he said. "I just finished." He held the instrument sideways and extended it across the counter to its owner. "Give it a try. See what you think." Cora blinked at him, then took the guitar and slung it over her own shoulder. While she adjusted its position a little, she gave him a rueful grin and said, This probably isn't going to sound like much. I'm as rusty as the guitar was.
Dallas grinned.
Don't worry about it, he said, sliding a pick across the counter to her. We don't discriminate.
Cora laughed, took the pick, and stood for a moment in thought, then touched the strings and played a slightly choppy but instantly recognizable rendition of the riff from Pipeline. As she got into it, her play got smoother. It wasn't perfect, but from the smile that spread across her face as she got reacquainted with her old friend, it didn't appear that she cared.
That's amazing, she said when she'd finished. You're a wizard. How much do I owe you?
Well, I have to charge you list for the parts, and there were a lot of them, I'm afraid, said Dallas. But I'm happy to donate my labor. It's been a slow day, he added before she could object. And bringing your guitar back to life? Well, it was for days like this that I got into this line of work in the first place. So let's call it an even trade. Okay?
Cora grinned.
Okay, she said. But I'm going to tell all my friends about you, she added, handing the guitar back so he could disconnect it from the shop amp and put it back in its case.
I never discourage word of mouth, Dallas said with a smile.
Nall was in the sun parlor when Corwin and Cora returned from the mainland, loaded down with an assortment of gear. Corwin had a gig bag slung on his back, while Cora was carrying a battered old hard guitar case. Both of them were lugging small amps, while Corwin's free hand was occupied with a large plastic shopping bag marked with the 10GL logo.
Starting a band? Nall wondered. Just jamming for the moment, Corwin told him, putting the shopping bag and his amp on the long table. Then he added wryly, We can't start a band until we find a drummer.
Iki plays drums, Cora said, putting her own amp down on the floor by the table.
Did I know that? Corwin wondered, looking thoughtful as he shrugged out of the straps of his gig bag. I must have known that. If nothing else, it's logical. No other instrument would have annoyed Genora as much, except maybe the vibraphone.
Nall snickered and stepped up to look over his shoulder as he put the bag on the table and unzipped it.
Did you buy another guitar?
Had to, Corwin replied, unconcerned.
How do you figure? Nall asked skeptically.
Look. So saying, Corwin drew the instrument out of the bag and held it up for the dragon's inspection.
Oh, said Nall.
It was a left-handed Gibson Thunderbird 4 bass guitar, evidently brand new, in black with a white pickguard and very dark rosewood fingerboard.
See? Corwin said, grinning.
Okay, yeah, said Nall after a moment. If you just randomly came across that out in the wild without special ordering it or anything, then I will agree that you really had no choice.
He gave a sage nod.
Well played, music shop. Well played. He hung around while they set up, unpacking the various supplies and secondary items they'd bought, then listened to half an hour or so of more or less random noodling around. Neither Corwin nor Cora had played in a while, rather more of one in her case, so they weren't what could be called polished, but they were clearly having a blast all the same. Nall headed back to the mainland at dusk, unconsciously humming the hook from Layla. Corwin and Cora jammed for another hour or so after Nall left, before deciding that the hour was late enough that they should probably knock off.
Phew, said Corwin, shaking his right hand as he placed his new T-bird on its stand with his left.
He crossed the room and reclined on the futon daybed, then regarded his hand.
My fingers are all tingly.
Yeah, mine too, said Cora. I'm so out of practice. She put her Strat in its case and closed it,
then went to the mini-fridge and got out a couple bottles of lychee juice. Tell you what, though. She sat down next to him, handed him one of the bottles, cracked her own, and drank most of it before adding, "That was fun."
"It sure was," Corwin agreed. "I was kidding Nall before, but maybe we should start a band. In our copious free time," he added wryly.
"Well, hey, now that most of the design work is done on the house," said Cora, leaving the rest of it unsaid. She finished her juice, tossed the bottle into the returnables bin, and then stretched out with her hands behind her head and got comfortable.
"So, Valhalla," she said after a few minutes of thoughtful silence.
"Yes," Corwin replied. She turned her head to regard him.
"Let's do it," she said. "Start the process anyway and see where it goes."
Corwin looked back at her for a few seconds, then nodded with a little smile.
"Okay," he said, and, settling back against the cushion behind him, he folded his hands on his chest and closed his eyes.
What are you doing?" Cora wondered after a few moments of silence. Corwin half opened one eye.
"Filing your application?" he said.
"By taking a nap?"
"It's a lot easier to get a message to Asgard from the spirit world," he pointed out.
"Oh. Yeah, I guess that would stand to reason, wouldn't it?" So saying, she lay back beside him and did likewise. They arrived in the spirit world to find it a crisp, clear evening, cooler than the weather in UA Bay tonight. Cora recognized the white chalk cliffs they were standing at the top of. They were at the same little bay where he'd arranged for her to spend some time with Katara on the day after her birthday, with the beach far below them and the pine forest whispering in the spirit wind at their backs. Corwin faced the sea of ghosts, straightened himself up as if about to bow, and clapped his hands together smartly in front of his chest, the way people from the Fire Nation did right after they rang the bell at a temple. That done, he tipped his head back and looked up at the brilliantly starlit sky. For a second, nothing happened. Then the Aesir brand on his forehead began to glow, faintly at first, and then brighter and brighter, until Cora had to shield her eyes with a hand and avoid looking directly at it. And with a thunderclap, a pulse of pure white light shot from it into the sky, momentarily illuminating the area with a sharp-shadowed photostrobe glare. Faint sounds of surprise and consternation drifted toward them from somewhere nearby as the echoes of the thunder rolled off into the night. Cora blinked the dazzle from her eyes to see Corwin smiling at her, his brand still flickering fitfully.
"There," he said. "Now we wait."
"For what?" Cora wondered. Corwin put a hand behind his head with a rueful little grin.
"The force against which even the gods themselves must contend in vain," he said. "The bureaucracy."
Saturday, May 22nd. International Police Station, Babylon 6. Bahava L System, Centaurus Sector. Utena's meeting with Queen Hippolyta of Themyscira was not, she had to admit, particularly well-timed. Besides the fact that she'd just been in the Bahava L system, there was the little matter of Annabelle and company having returned to Air Temple Island the day before. Anthe and Nima reported that the baby had appeared to enjoy their quick tour of the air temples, but she had a restless first night back, what with the travel fatigue and all. Coupled with her own adjustment to having everyone back home again, it left Utena ill-prepared for a summons to an emergency meeting with a displaced head of state on Babylon 6. Still, it was what it was, and when duty called, the Prince of Sephiro answered. Judging from the capsule description of events the chief had provided when he called, the situation was serious enough that only her personal attention would do. The meeting itself lasted only a few minutes, and could probably have been conducted by video, except for the obvious diplomatic necessity of handling it face to face. Of course, if they had done it as a video conference, Utrinna probably would have been able to prevent Her Majesty from seeing the colossal yawn she was unable to suppress at one point. Fortunately, the Queen of the Amazons was apparent herself, and so understood with a ready, kindly smile when Utrinna sheepishly remarked, "Sorry, 2-month-old in the house." With their business concluded, Hippolyta took herself off to gather her sisters and prepare them for the journey to their new home in Sephiro. Anthea and Mitsuru would take care of the actual transport once the arrangements were all complete. Utrinna, sitting at Griffin's desk in the chief's little-used Babylon 6 office, finished drafting a note to that effect for the Seneschal's records, then sat back in her chair and considered her options. She had, glance at watch, 6 hours before the Blink Dog would return to take her back to Zipang. She supposed she could go to the VOQ and get some sleep while she waited. She really was tired. Annabelle was, in her admittedly biased opinion, the best baby in the history of ever, but even the best babies have off days. On the other hand, it was only 14-20 hours, and she'd have plenty of time to sleep on the train back to Republic City. She had just about decided to go down to the Zocalo and see if the little coffee shop next to Garrick's was still there, when the intercom on Griffin's desk beeped. Utrinna blinked at it. Who knew or cared that she was here? Then pressed the button and said, "Yes?" "Babylon Control here, Commodore," said the voice of the station's ops officer, a Starfleet lieutenant by the name, amusingly enough to Utrinna, of David Corwin. "The captain of the KDF battlecruiser Nodui would like to meet you in Transporter Room 2 if you have the time." Utrinna's puzzlement deepened. She only knew one Klingon battlecruiser's captain, and that was Captain Krontap of the Khoskaj. But he and his ship were parsecs from here, serving as the IPSF's main link to the Klingon government in exile on Klingjai Prime. She considered the name, Nodui, who strikes back. A good name for a Klingon Union ship, particularly if his captain were of a mind to take the fight to the Klavarite forces. "Commodore?" Lieutenant Corwin's voice inquired. Sure, I can spare a few minutes," she said. "I'll be right there." She got up from the desk, tucking the note to Mitsuru into the inside pocket of her leather jacket, and made her way to the transporter room, her curiosity running high. When she arrived, the technician on duty was just energizing the beam. A trio of people materialized on the frontmost 3 disks of the array. Utrinna initially thought the one on the left was human, until she looked more closely and realized he was a Klingon with humanoid gene mods, like the actor who played Sub-Commander Dorn on Battlecruiser Vengeance. He was dressed like a Battlecruiser Vengeance character, too, in the simple, unarmored tunic and trousers of a 22nd-century KDF lieutenant's uniform, and sported a pointed beard and mustache combo somewhere between a Van Dyke and a Fu Manchu. There was no mistaking the massive figure on the right. He was a Gorn, tall and broad, dressed in the newfangled reinforced leather gear that the KDF had lately been adopting, so that its people could be told apart from those of Klavor's Imperial Navy at a glance. If Utrinna remembered the memo she'd received correctly, the color scheme, mostly black with some dark red accents, indicated that he was a science officer, and the pattern of decorative metal bands on the leather baldric he wore slung across his barrel chest denoted the rank of sub-commander. That left the person in the middle, and she was perhaps the most unexpected of all. She was a Klingon woman. Her skin tone and the ridges on her forehead made that plain enough, but she was very young to be a warship's commander. She was also tiny for a Klingon, an inch or two less than Utrina's own 5'11", which was itself not a very impressive height by Klingon standards. Her head was shaved, her heavy eyebrows trimmed into neatly tapering wedges. The latter gave her expression a permanent touch of a scowl, even when, as now, she was smiling. Like the Gorn, she was dressed in the new KDF uniform, but its accents were gold-toned instead of red, and she sported an armored collar and a single pauldron on her left shoulder, decorated with the scarlet badge of General Zarg Thalek's 7th Fleet. Her baldric was a much more elaborate affair than the Gorn's as well, of intricately articulated metal mesh instead of leather, with the bands and badge of a full commander. At her belt she wore a brace of heavy disruptor pistols with finely worked grips of lacquered grillwood. Utrina had taken all that on board before something about the young Klingon's face struck her. Blinking in surprise, she took a closer look, her eyes going wide. Still smiling mischievously, the Klingon captain stepped down from the transporter platform, still flanked by her officers, and gave Utrina a fist-to-chest salute. The transporter room's lights glinted from the silver and rose ring she wore on the third finger of her left hand as she said, "The one greets you," thought Admiral Utrina Vestai Tenjo, Master-at-Arms to Great House Hutchins. "I am Commander Belana Sutai O'Brien of the battlecruiser Retaliator." Utrina stared at her for a second longer, then pulled herself together and returned the salute as creditably as she knew how. "Kai, Ratwit, Sutai O'Brien, Nuknech." Belana grinned, suddenly transforming from the finely turned-out Klingon captain back into herself. "Right now," she said in standard, "I could go for some coffee that wasn't made from recycled urine. Before we go, though, let me introduce my riot squad." She indicated the humanized Klingon, who stood looking around with keen, dark eyes as if sizing the room up for a squad-level takedown. "My tactical officer, Lieutenant Karn Vestai Kareth." "An honor, Commodore," said Karn with a salute. His eyes gave her the same assessment they'd given the room, gauging her height, build, stance, demeanor, all in the name of building up the most complete tactical picture of her, just in case he had to take her down. There was nothing aggressive or threatening about it, just pure, pragmatic professionalism. That was his job, and he was, Utrina was reasonably sure, always doing it, whether he knew it consciously or not. She could respect that, even if it was a little unsettling. "And this is my first officer, the Science Gorn," Belana went on. Utrina raised an eyebrow. "Science Gorn?" "It is a sufficient descriptor," the Gorn remarked, saluting her with a slight bow. "No other Gorn science officers in the KDF, you see," said Belana with a wink. "He's a little weird. Now, about that coffee." Over said coffee, at a little table on the Zocalo, Belana, at Utrina's insistence, told the dramatic story of how she had acquired her command. Utrina, in turn, caught Belana up on all that had been going on, as far as she herself was aware, in duelist circles, commiserating with her that the demands of the service had kept her away from Bajor the previous weekend. They were just getting into the subject of what Utrina herself had been up to in the last few months, when the harsh, grating noise of a Klingon communicator demanding attention interrupted them. Looking faintly surprised, Belana took the device from her belt and triggered it. "Speak," Belana said curtly into the communicator. The voice that replied was unknown to Utrina, other than that she could tell it was male, most probably Klingon, and sounded excited about something. "My lord, we have them." Belana's face took on a smile that was not entirely nice. "Excellent," she replied, her tone combining great satisfaction and eager anticipation. "Hands to quarters. Prepare the ship for departure. Action."
"Acting, my lord," the voice from the ship replied.
Standing, Belana said to her officers, "Gentlemen, we're up." Turning to Utina, she added apologetically, "I hate to eat and run, Commodore, but..."
Utina got to her feet with a smile.
"Kapla rat wi sutai O'Brien,"
she said, offering the younger captain a bow and a Klingon-style salute. Belana grinned at her, winked, and then said into her communicator,
"No dwi, jol yichu."
And without so much as a word from Karn or the Science Gorn, the three were gone, whisked away in a wash of orange light that took a number of people in the surrounding area by surprise, to judge by the murmurs and double takes it caused. Still chuckling at Belana's eagerness, Utina returned to her seat and her coffee. She wondered who they were, and how exactly the Retaliator had them, but really it was none of her business. She wasn't a KDF officer, and even in the IPSF reserve she wasn't currently on active duty. She had, as the saying went, no need to know. She finished her coffee, then looked at her watch. Still more than 4 hours to go before the blink dog could fit her into its busy schedule. Then an hour or so to get out of the pattern at B6, jump to Zipong, get down to Psycho International, and clear customs. Taxicab to the railroad station, then 50 or so hours on the train. Walk down to the ferry port and wait for the next run to the island. She'd be home sometime early Monday evening. Ah, the hell with that, she thought. And then, "Corwin, I need an exit." Corwin's psychic voice had a palpable smile in it as he replied, "We were wondering how long it would take you to call. Anthy says you're cute when you're being stubborn." Utina rolled her eyes with a slightly blushing grin. "Yeah, yeah." "Okay, not a problem," Corwin went on, sounding cheerfully brisk. "Stand up and hold still." As she got to her feet and put some money on the table, Utina looked at her lens, one eyebrow crooking. "I'm on the Zocalo," she said. "There are no windows around." "Not a problem," Corwin repeated. "Just hold still." Air Temple Island, Republic City, Decho. As they were passing by what, at that point, had long since come to be known among the island's youngsters as the guest house, Sita, Tenzin, and Gyatso saw Anthy and Corwin standing out in the courtyard by the decorative pond. Gyatso started to call out to them, but before he could do so, Sita put out a hand and stopped him. "Shh," she said, shaking her head. "Look, Lady Anthy's busy." Puzzled, Gyatso looked more closely, and after a moment he saw what Sita meant. Anthy wasn't just standing there regarding the pool, as she sometimes did. She had her eyes closed and her face set in a look of firm concentration. Although concentrating on what, Gyatso couldn't have said. There wasn't anything around, and she wouldn't have been looking at it if there was. She had her hands spread, palms downward, her fingers spread and slightly bent. "What's she doing?" Tenzin wondered. "I have no idea," Sita replied. For several seconds, as the three watched from the far side of the pond, nothing happened. Then, slowly, almost subliminally, they became aware of a soft but growing sound, a low rumbling, as of a still distant but approaching train. Beside Sita, Tenzin caught his breath audibly as he realized that Anthy's hands were starting to glow, a strange, silvery light gathering at her fingertips and spreading to encompass her whole hands. The glow grew brighter and denser as the rumbling sound grew louder, the tension visible in her arms and on her forehead now. Suddenly, she moved, raising one hand and flexing it inward as she closed that hand into a fist, as if grabbing something out of the air and pulling it toward her. And with a thundery sound and a great burst of that silver light, Utna appeared out of nowhere next to her, dressed in her familiar black and red and looking startled.
"Whoa," said Gyatso.
"I concur," Tenzin murmured, nodding with eyes wide.
"Okay, that was different,"
Utna observed, recovering her aplomb with only a moment's disorientation. "Welcome home, darling," said Anthy, embracing her with a kiss. "What she said," Corbin added cheerfully, taking his turn. Before Utna could reply, if she planned to, the house's front door opened and a number of people spilled out.
"What was that noise? Oh, hey," said Wakaba. "Look, Annabelle, your other dad's home early."
Utna looked and saw that her old friend did, indeed, have Annabelle aboard, lashed to her chest in the approved manner with Anthe's airbender sash and garnet on her shoulder. She laughed and said,
"You guys look comfy."
"All in a day's work for Aunt Wakaba," declared Wakaba, fists on hips. "You missed her first attempt with the rap," Cora remarked with a grin.
"But Anthe got pictures," Nima added.
"You guys are so mean to me," Wakaba complained. Utna tilted her head inquisitively.
"Were you getting ready to go someplace?"
Corwin nodded. "We were just about to head into town. Nall, Lokpa, and the fire ferrets are going to meet us for dinner at Celestial P. I know you've had a pretty long day," he added, "but do you think you're up for coming with?"
"No big if not," Wakaba put in. "We'll bring you back something."
Utna considered that for a moment, taking in the mix of friends, old and new, and her growing family that surrounded her, where moments before she had been millions of miles away among strangers. The shape of her entire life had changed so much, and in ways she could never possibly have predicted. Coming back to it from even a brief time away was always a bit of a shock, and coupled with the transport lag and the fact that she'd been underslept to begin with, she figured that by rights she should be up for little more than lying down in a cool, dark place for a while. But the more she thought about her whole life situation lately, the more excited she was to see whatever came next. Getting to know a whole new world, suddenly gaining not just a child, but an even bigger extended family. Finding new ways of making it all work with her responsibilities, old and new. It was a big, and in many ways an unexpected, challenge, but... "Yeah," she said, her smile a bit tired, but heartfelt. "I think I'm up for that." Aery Productions Unlimited and Magnetic Terrapin Studios presented Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, The Legacy of Korra and the Order of the Rose, Suite for Avatar and Trinity, the Dicho Suite, Fifth Movement, Among Honest Hearts. This concludes the Dicho Suite. The Otori Institute, Orifos. Headmaster Akio Otori was standing at the window of his office, thoughtfully considering the advanced students at their drills down on the quad, when the Castellan entered. "They've become quite skilled," Akio remarked conversationally, not turning to look at her, as the Castellan crossed his office and stopped before his desk. "I must remember to congratulate Mikage on his efforts when he returns." The Castellan, her face impassive, offered no comment on that matter. Instead, she placed a small, buff-colored envelope on his desk blotter and said, "My lord, we have them." Akio stayed at the window for a moment longer. When at last he turned to face the Castellan, it was with a darkly satisfied smile playing at his lips. Excellent, he said. Then it seems we're nearly ready to begin at last. The Order of the Rose, a duelist opera, will resume with the fifth movement, Taken by Storm.